Setlist in association with 7Digital.
This week, TV, music, Tencent and Soundgarden. Welcome to Setlist, the music business podcast from CMU. I'm Andy Malt. With me is Chris Cook. Hello, Chris.
You sound surprised that I'm here.
I am.
I'm here. Hello.
Hello. As ever, we are going to take a look back through some of the biggest and most interesting music business news stories of the last week or so.
More than a week.
More than a week, because we had a special edition last week, and despite it being the end of the year when nothing interesting happens, something interesting happened, so we're going to talk about it.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, so even though we are sticking to our commitment to be weekly, I wasn't here. So we couldn't have a usual edition last week because I was in Thailand. That was nice.
On your, what, 17th holiday of the year?
It was very nice. I was working, let's not forget that, working very hard in Thailand.
I find that very hard to believe.
But the good news is we had a little special edition in our pocket, so we had yet more prints.
Yeah.
Done two specials on prints now, Canna, haven't
back
we?
Back-to-back specials, even though there was about 3 months between them.
So that was last week, but yeah, we are back for one last edition for 2019.
Yeah.
Because we are going to take a Christmas break.
We are.
Despite our commitment to be weekly, we should have put a little asterisk when we made that commitment. We're still taking Christmas off.
Yeah, well, no one wants podcasts at Christmas.
Well, especially not music business podcasts.
No.
Maybe fun, story-based documentary podcasts, but not music business news. So this is our last one before the Christmas break. But as you say, yes, in the fortnight since we were last here, some interesting stuff has happened, which means we do actually have something to talk about.
Yeah, yeah. So that's fun. Shall I tell you what we're going to talk about?
What are we going to talk about?
This week, we are going to talk about Tencent Scrabble to save its Universal Music deal and the dispute over unreleased Soundgarden recordings. But first, there has been a variety of chatter about TV music royalties lately from various angles. And we're going to talk about all that. The big one is Discovery Networks in the US, which owns various channels, including the Discovery Channel.
That's the one you've probably heard of.
And it is apparently imposing new contract terms that could see songwriters paid a great deal less from their music when used on its TV shows.
Yeah, so this is really about how the songwriters get paid, as you said there. I suppose it's interesting because earlier this year, through the Dissecting Digital Dollar work we do with the MMF, we spent quite a lot of time thinking about how songwriters get paid, or not, from their streaming money.
Yeah.
So it's interesting that as the year ends, we're still talking about how songwriters get paid or not, but nothing to do with streaming. Well, except that we are going to talk about Netflix. I guess that's streaming, but nothing to do with audio streaming. We're not talking about Spotify or Apple here. We are talking about the money that songwriters get paid when their music gets used on TV programs.
Which is, I mean, as it's become harder to make money from recordings, making money from syncs is what the thing that people talk about.
And they do.
It's the thing everyone's striving for, to try to get sync deals.
People do tend to exaggerate how big this is.
They do, but it is increasingly, when I talk to artists, whereas, you know, they used to talk about wanting a record deal or wanting to make money off their records, now they're like, I want to get a sync deal. I want to get something on TV so that I can eat some food.
Yeah, that's because they've bought into the myth that syncs are much bigger deal than it is. However, we are talking about songwriters here, and it's worth mentioning that while on the recording side of the business, sync is still really quite small, it is true that for songwriters, sync from TV or any other sort of, you know, audiovisual output is a much bigger part when we talk about songs, we talk about publishing, partly because on the recording side, when we're talking about music that gets synchronized into a TV program or a movie or whatever, it does tend to be commercially released music. So music that the artist and the label have already released, it's on Spotify, it's had its marketing, blah, blah, blah. And then a movie or a TV company or a gaming company or whatever want to then synchronize that recording into their audiovisual product. But on the songwriting side, there are other ways that songwriters make money out of this side of the business, which A, is why sync is a bigger deal for songwriters and publishers. And also, it's the other side that is relevant to what we're talking about today.
Yeah.
So we're not talking about when you license a commercially released track and then you have to license a song in that as well. We are talking about original commissions and production music. So this is where people create music specifically to go in a TV program or a movie or a game or whatever. So it's not that they're writing a song that's going to have a commercial release and then subsequently be synchronized. They're specifically writing music for TV or whatever. And in the case of original commission, they would be writing it with a specific program in mind. So the Discovery Channel would say, what do they have on the Discovery Channel? We've got a documentary about
discovering stuff.
About discovering stuff. About, I don't know, whales.
Yeah.
Documentary about whales, yeah, on the Discovery Channel. We're having a documentary all about whales, and we need a great soundtrack to go with our documentary. You know, imagine the whales swimming around in the sea, being all dramatic, and we need a dramatic bit of music to go with it.
I'm sure that's the pitch.
That's how it's explained to these musicians, except...
Do something dramatic.
Do something dramatic that's whale-like. Whereas production music is where you create music that is composed with some sort of TV program or movie or whatever in mind.
But maybe not a specific one.
Not a specific one. So you're sort of thinking, okay, let's assume there's going to be a TV program that needs music for nighttime or for pictures of the Arctic or for something festive or, I don't know, some sort of horrible war type thing.
Oh, well, that sounds awful.
Well, those documentary channels, they're always having programs about the Nazis, aren't they?
Oh, they are.
I don't know if the History Channel is part of Discovery Network.
I don't think it is.
But it is basically just a channel of back-to-back Nazi documentaries. So I imagine if you're in the production music business, you write lots of music that you can see soundtracking one of the thousands and thousands of Nazi documentaries that are going to be made. So it's this side of synchronization we're talking about, where composers, songwriters, whatever we're calling them, create a piece of music either for a specific TV program, movie, whatever, or for a library where the producers of a TV program, movie, whatever, will subsequently then sort of license the music in the future. And we're interested in how people get paid on this side. And I guess it all comes down to, well, okay, if I'm a songwriter, I'm not.
You're not.
You did compose the theme tune to Setlist.
I did. I'm yet to be paid. I think we'll come on to that.
You haven't been paid either of the two chunks of money we're going to talk about here. I'm not sure it's good enough. I think that's the problem.
I don't think that's relevant. I believe it was signed off and used. Doesn't matter how good it is.
So, all right then, Andy Malt, famous theme tune composer.
Yeah.
So let's say that Andy Malt was going to compose a piece of music for the Discovery Network or for a production music library.
I might do.
Piece of music, I don't know. Maybe you could do something for that whale documentary or the Nazi program.
I've got some ideas.
I think the Setlist theme tune would probably work for either of those.
Yeah.
You could just expand on your existing theme.
Yeah.
So you're going to create some music. I'm the TV network or I'm the production music company. And you come to me and we do a deal.
Mm-hmm.
And let's say that not only are you going to write that music, you're also going to make a recording of it. Because that's what you did. Because you're a...
Oh, yeah.
Not only a songwriter, you're also a producer.
Yeah. Why are you laughing?
I don't know.
That's what I do. those are my jobs.
So
this
Andy,
is just my hobby.
Andy Malt, composer, producer, is going to...
Stop laughing!
...is going to be making this piece of music... And so, therefore, two different copyrights are going to be created there, aren't there?
There are, yes.
There's going to be copyright in the actual composition, and there's going to be copyright in the recording. And so the question is, well, who owns that copyright? Do I own it as the TV network or the production music company, or do you own it as the composer slash producer? And with production music, generally the deal is that I, as the production music company, would be wanting to own at the least the recording rights and probably the so-called mechanical rights in the song.
Yeah.
Because the whole point of production music is it's really easy to license. So I need to be in a position that when somebody wants to use your great composition in their Nazi documentary, that I can just give them a license and there's no complication. I don't have to go and do a deal with you. There's no other co-writers or anything like that. The whole point of production music is it's as simple as possible. So for my business to work, I need you to assign me the recording rights and the mechanical rights in the song, and then I pay you some money to make that worth your while.
Yeah.
When it comes to the TV network and the original composition, actually there was a time where probably you would look to keep control of the copyright, certainly the song copyright and maybe even the recording copyright, and then license it to me. So even though I've commissioned it, and I gave you that excellent brief earlier.
Yes, I remember it, yes.
That you wrote the music to. But you might say, well, okay, you are going to keep the copyrights, and then you'll license it to me so I can do whatever I need with it, and I'll pay you a chunk of money for that. But then you would own the copyright in it. So then let's say somebody wanted to release it as a soundtrack, you would still have all the rights there. You might want to use it in something else. You might want to perform it, whatever. However, we have seen a trend over the last 20 years, really, where increasingly TV companies, movie companies, even ad agencies have started saying to people, OK, if we're commissioning this, we want to own the rights.
Yes.
And we'll give you a big chunk of money up front, but then we will own the copyright in the recording. We will own the mechanical rights in the song. And then if there's a soundtrack, we'll do that. And if we're going to use it in some show, we'll do that, and so on and so forth. And so songwriters and composers, they've been trying to push back on that trend, but it has become very common. However, I've been talking about mechanical rights in songs here for a reason. Because generally speaking, with production music and original commissions, even where the library or the commissioner is taking the rights, what a songwriter would often refer to as a buyout deal, the performing rights in the song, in the composition, are not included in the buyout. So I, as the TV network or the production music library, I will get the recording rights, I will get the mechanical rights in the song, but I would not get the performing rights. And what that means is every time my Nazi documentary goes out, or whatever documentaries have taken the production music, I mean, that could be 10 different documentaries all using that piece of production music. Every time those documentaries go out, whether that's out on TV network or whether it's screened in a cinema or whether it's streamed online, because that is a communication or a performance, you would be due more money in addition to what I paid you up front. And you would get that money through your collecting society. So in the UK, PRS will collect that money. If the programme went out in the States or it went out in Germany, the local collecting societies will collect the money. They would pass it back to PRS. And so in addition to whatever I paid you up front, you would get those extra royalties. So even though in production music, the libraries generally want rights ownership, in original commissions, rights ownership on the part of the commissioner has become increasingly common, it is generally true that in most scenarios, you would, as the composer, continue to get your performing right royalties on the song side through the collective licensing system. And that is what Discovery networks are trying to change.
Yes, so Variety reported earlier this month, Discovery has informed many of its top composers that beginning in 2020, they must give up all performance royalties paid for US airings and that they must sign away their ability to collect royalties on all past shows on its networks. Now, so the Discovery Networks owns, as we said, Discovery Channel. It also has Animal Planet, HGTV and the Food Network.
So this announcement on the part of Discovery Networks has, needless to say, proven quite controversial within the songwriter community. It's also interesting that this report in Variety followed an article in Billboard also earlier this month about Netflix's deals with the musicians and composers that they work with.
Yes.
And apparently there had been some event and the Netflix contract had been discussed. And anyway, this Billboard article was saying that Netflix template agreement with its composers also has a similar line, which says that when this goes out in the US, you're not going to get any other royalties. That's all included in this initial deal. You're giving up all rights to future royalties for US streams under this contract. And then Netflix also got a bit of stick from that, although the responses of the two companies have been different, because Netflix basically said, OK, that might be in our template agreement, but every agreement is up for negotiation. It's not a deal breaker. We wouldn't refuse to work with a composer because they wouldn't sign up to that term. Whereas a spokesperson for Discovery Networks, once people started criticising this, well, they just issued quite a vague statement where they didn't really deal with this change in the contracts. It was kind of a, but we give loads of money to musicians of all of our programmes type quote.
Yeah, they said, our 8,000 hours of original programming a year drives enormous economic value to the global music community. We compensate countless composers and musicians for their valued contributions and will continue to do so. But they stop there and they don't go as far as saying, but not as much. And that's the issue, isn't it? They're still saying they'll pay songwriters for their contributions, but just not as much.
And what songwriters are saying is that, OK, yes, you're going to carry on paying us those upfront fees. That's great. But the way this side of the songwriting business works, the upfront fees aren't enough. And that the people who do this for a living, they rely on having these two revenue streams. They rely on, yes, they get the upfront fees when they create some music, whether it's to a commission or whether it's for a production music library. But then they have the second revenue stream, which is if that music gets used in a show, particularly if it's a show that then goes on repeat on a TV network somewhere where it's just being played all the time, or it becomes a big hit on a Netflix type service and people are streaming it all the time, then there's additional income coming down the line. And basically what they're saying is those composers, those songwriters who operate in this space, who generally aren't artists who are off also having a recording career, they are people who are doing this predominantly as their main job, that the way the business is set up, they need the two sides, they need the two revenue streams, and without it, it just becomes unviable, is what songwriters are saying. ASCAP, the American Collecting Society, so that's the society...
Or one of the American Collecting Societies.
One of the four American Collecting Societies that represent the performing rights in songs. So one of the societies who would usually collect these additional royalties for their members in the US and also for other songwriters affiliated to other societies around the world. They issued a statement last week and they said back-end royalties, so that's what we're calling this repeat payment that comes in down the line, Back-end royalties for composers who write for TV, cable and streaming shows are critical to their being able to sustain a livelihood. ASCAP is very alarmed, they're alarmed, by these reports that Discovery Networks have a new policy toward composers which would have devastating impact on the royalty streams of those composers and make it near impossible for these music creators to make a living from their compositions. Composers should have agency and choice when it comes to licensing the music they create, but an ultimatum, so basically take it or leave it, which is what Discovery Networks are saying, is not a choice. Composers are an important part of the creative teams that make a show successful, and it is disappointing that Discovery would not recognise the true value their work brings to these shows. We hope Discovery Networks will change their position. But given we're a UK-based podcast,
we are.
It is interesting looking at this from a European perspective, because actually, if you were a UK-based songwriter, composer, a member of the society here, PRS, you wouldn't be allowed to do the deal that Discovery Networks now has on the table. Because in the UK, when you join PRS as a composer, as a songwriter, you assign the performing rights in every song you've ever written and every song you will ever write to PRS. So PRS now control the performing rights, which means that if a network comes along and says, OK, as part of this deal we're doing, in return for this upfront fee, will you either assign us the performing rights or at the very least bundle in any payments that are due on the performing rights? A UK songwriter would have to say, I can't do that deal because they're not my rights. They're PRS's rights. So I can't include the performing rights in this deal because they're not mine. I can't waive any future performing right payments because they're not my rights. You'll have to go and talk to PRS and get a license and do a deal. So that's how it works in most of the world. The US is quite unusual in that when a writer or composer joins a BMI or an ASCAP, they're not giving the society any exclusive control over those performing rights. You have to allow BMI and ASCAP to license those performing rights. So BMI and ASCAP could license the performing rights to Discovery Networks, but crucially, BMI and ASCAP don't have exclusive control over those performing rights, so they can't stop their members from doing a side deal with Discovery Networks that says, OK, even though these rights will sit in ASCAP and BMI, in this scenario, I'm going to waive all of those royalties forever in return for the upfront fee. So there is a difference of how all this works in Europe versus the US. But from a European perspective, it has been interesting with all the chatter around Discovery Networks and that Netflix contract. You have got people over here saying, well, in theory, the way the industry is set up in Europe, and in some cases copyright law interferes in this as well, it protects songwriters from what Discovery Networks are proposing in the US. Although there is a fear, A, that will exclude European composers from being able to work for networks in the US,
yeah,
which is a problem. Also, because we're kind of getting into this era where, whereas previously TV operated on a country-by-country basis. Every TV network was based in one country. It would have relationships with the local music industry. Obviously, in the age of Netflix and Amazon Prime and now all these new Disney Plus, Apple TV Plus type services, TV is becoming global. And so there is a fear that the big media companies might try and force the American system onto the European music industries as well. So although this is a US story and it will most directly affect US-based songwriters or those songwriters who are very active in the US, there is a fear that is this setting a precedent that could start to infiltrate elsewhere in the world.
Yes, and talking of Europe, there has been one similar debate going on over here as well in relation to Epidemic Sound, the production music company.
Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it, that in the same week, more or less, that the whole Discovery Networks thing and the Netflix thing was kicking off in the US, we suddenly had a statement from the European Composer and Songwriter Alliance about the business model of this Swedish company that we have talked about before on Setlist called Epidemic Sound. And it's interesting because this company's been going for quite a while.
Yeah.
Its model has been similar from the start, but the criticism of Epidemic Sound last week was, in essence, exactly the same criticism as Discovery Networks and Netflix in the US regarding the performing right royalties. So I don't know whether that's just a coincidence and whether the European songwriter group had been preparing the statement for some time or whether it was motivated by the conversation going on in the US. But Epidemic Sound is a very interesting production music company. There are many, many production music companies around the world. And as I've already said, the whole point of production music, the whole reason we have these libraries is to try and make it easier and cheaper for TV companies, movie companies, gaming companies, ad agencies, etc., to license music, because we all know licensing music's a freaking nightmare and, yeah. And licensing for traditional sync deals is the hardest bit. And so library music is basically a service where you say to TV companies, movie companies, gaming companies, okay, if you have the time and the money, of course you would like to have a big hit record in your soundtrack. But if you don't have the time or you don't have the money, well, here's another option, and that's production music, which is cheaper and easier to license. And generally, because the libraries have nice databases, it's cheaper and easier to find the music you're going to use. Now, many production music companies actually license through the collective licensing system. So you actually, it's all set rates, and you have a PRS and an MCPS license here in the UK, similar elsewhere in the world, and it all just goes through the collective licensing system. There are some libraries, the big one over here is Audio Network, where you actually license the recording bit and the mechanical rights bit directly off the library. But crucially, as with all the examples we've spoken about earlier, the performing rights sit outside of that. So with most music libraries, even if there's some direct licensing going on, when the music gets played on a TV station or it gets streamed or it's a movie being screened in a cinema, the performing rights are not included in the library's deal. The library doesn't even have the performing rights, and you have to go to PRS or whoever. You will still need a PRS license. And Epidemic Sound is unique in that it is the one truly one-stop shop music library. When it works with musicians, it takes the recording rights and all elements of the song rights as part of its deal with those musicians and those composers, which means it can then go to its licensees and give them a truly one-stop shop license. And we've talked about Epidemic Sound in the past for two reasons. First of all, although they do work with conventional broadcasters, they are particularly known in the YouTube creator space.
Yeah.
Because when the whole YouTube creator thing was really starting to take off, whenever that was, 5 years ago, those YouTube creators suddenly realized that if they put commercially released music into their videos, some record company will come along and either block the video or take all the ad income associated with the video. So you have these YouTube creators thinking, oh my God, we can't use commercially released music. They learned about library music. The problem is all these other libraries, there's still the complications of having to go and get a PRS license. And so Epidemic Sound, very cleverly, in my opinion, spotted a gap in the market where they could come in and say, okay, we are the company that can give you a really easy one-stop shop license with some music to put in your YouTube videos. And they basically took that market. And in some ways, they spotted an area where the traditional music industry was failing to adapt and to respond to this new need, more grassroots need for music to be synced into video. And Epidemic Sound swooped in and took that market. Of course, the other reason we spoke about them previously on Setlist, the whole fake artists hoo-ha, and the idea that Spotify's ambient go-to-sleep playlists were all full of music by artists no one had ever heard of, that was Epidemic Sound. A lot of the music in those ambient go-to-sleep chill-out playlists on Spotify is just music coming out of the Epidemic Sound library, because another genius move on Epidemic Sound. I mean, obviously, the songwriters are not happy with this company, and we're about to explain why. But in my opinion, another genius move on this company was what they recognised was, well, in the music industry, there's always been a belief that production music is a bit shit. And it's great for a documentary, it's fine in a drama, but nobody would want to listen to it in isolation. And what Epidemic Sound realised, actually by looking at the comments under the YouTube videos that was using their music, was people did want to listen to some of their library music. And once those chill-out ambient playlists started taking off on Spotify, and no record companies were releasing music appropriate for those playlists, they were like, well, we've got loads of music. And so they started pushing their music into Spotify, and that was where the whole fake artist hoo-ha came from. So you can tell, I'm quite impressed with Epidemic Sound. But crucially, for all of that to work, and this is where it's got controversial, they do take the performing rights in the music from the musicians they work with. And in order for that to happen over here in Europe, that means the musicians they work with have to sit outside the collective licensing system. They can't be a PRS member or gamer member or STIM member. They have to be outside the collective, which means that the musicians making music for Epidemic Sound, they can't have lots of other projects on the go. They certainly couldn't be artists where they're off gigging and performing and releasing their own music. So the Epidemic Sound model does restrict what the musicians who work with them can do. That said, there are musicians out there who just want to make music for a living. They don't want to be pop stars. They don't want to be writing for pop stars. They just love making music. And to have, you know, a steady living just making music that then gets used by YouTube creators and TV companies and pops up on Spotify playlists, for a certain sort of musician, that's the dream job. And Epidemic Sound would say, well, that's the business model we've set up. We've spotted some gaps in the market. We're filling those gaps in the market. We've set up a new model to make it happen. The musicians we're working with are happy. What's the problem? But last week, EXA, the European Body of Songwriters, well, they told us what, in their opinion, is the problem.
Yeah, they put out a statement addressing TV companies directly. I mean, specifically the Swedish Public Service TV, which licenses music from Epidemic Sound, saying any company should refrain from collaborating with an entity which disrespects authors and their basic economic and moral rights. Then switching to talking to songwriters, they said all our fellow music authors should refrain from signing any agreement which results in giving up all their economic rights forever, while not even being given credit according to his or her right by law.
That last point relates to the fact that some, I don't know if it's all, but certainly some of the music in the Epidemic Sound library is credited to Epidemic Sound. So if a TV programme uses it, in the credits at the end, rather than saying who actually wrote and recorded the music, it will just say Epidemic Sound.
Yeah.
And so what EXA are saying is, not only do they object to the business model where the production music company gets the performing rights as well, forcing the musicians and composers to sit outside the creative licensing system, they also are offended by the idea that music would be officially credited to Epidemic Sound. It is a moral right under copyright law that a songwriter or composer gets credited for their work. That is, even here in the UK, where we have pretty rubbish moral rights, It is there in law. And so they're saying that basically Epidemic Sound is not respecting the moral right to attribution of the composer. Although, I mean, it has to be said, in the production music space, it is quite common for artists and composers and songwriters who work in production music to do so under a pseudonym, or often many pseudonyms. So many musicians and composers making music for music libraries, they are not putting that music under their own name. And partly because, you know, some people, I mean, these people couldn't work for Epidemic Sound because of the model. But, you know, there are some people who have one life over here as an artist with a fan base putting out music, another life over here making music for libraries because it gives them some extra cash. And they don't want the fans over here knowing that on the side they wrote that soundtrack for the Nazi documentary over here. So it is actually quite common to use pseudonyms in production music. But it, who knows whether or not there are musicians working for Epidemic Sound who would like to be credited and they're not being. Epidemic Sound did issue a response.
Yes, they said, we were surprised to find out that EXA has publicly condemned Epidemic without engaging with us or, to our knowledge, any of our musicians. But it is not so surprising that they took this viewpoint as they come from the more traditional part of the industry, which we're disrupting.
They then went on, our door is always open and we're happy to sit down with EXA to bring them up to speed on how our model is perfectly suited to the distribution of music in the digital age. Actually, they could just listen to the episode of Setlist where we talked about the whole fake artist thing, because I think I did a quite good job of explaining the Epidemic Sound model then. And they should come and talk to our musicians and they could hear firsthand how those musicians, those composers, that team like the Epidemic Sound business model because it supports them both financially and creatively. So interesting that on both sides of the Atlantic, similar, although slightly different discussions going on regarding how rights are organised and structured and how royalties are paid when music gets used on TV programmes, etc., whether that's through production music libraries or through original commissions.
Still to come, legal action over the potential final Soundgarden album, but now Tencent, the Chinese web giant, is frantically trying to save its deal to take a stake in Universal Music, and in fact, as a result, might take a bigger stake than it had originally planned.
Yeah, this is based on sources who've been talking to Reuters, and it's just come in not long before we've recorded this edition of Setlist. But we did talk previously about how, after talking for a whole year, this is Vivendi, the owners of Universal Music, talked for a whole year about how they were going to sell up to 50% of Universal Music, biggest music rights company in the world. And then there was lots of speculation that Tencent, which obviously is the biggest player in streaming music in China, has lots of different sides to its business, big tech company, as we've already discussed, but very active in streaming music in China, has some interest elsewhere in the world as well. But it was rumoured pretty early on that it was in talks with Vivendi to take a stake in Universal Music. And then it was confirmed this autumn that, yes, that deal had been negotiated and that it was now in its final stages, and it was looking like that Tencent was going to take 10% of Universal Music in return for a big chunk of money, with an option at some point down the line to double that so that it would have a 20% stake in Universal Music. And then there were various statements from Vivendi saying, OK, this is basically in the final stages of deal-making now. It's looking very, very likely this is going to go through. Meanwhile, Impala, which represents the indie labels in Europe, had already put out a statement confirming that it was planning on taking this deal to the competition regulators within the European Union, raising various concerns about Tencent taking a 10% stake of Universal Music, particularly given it's already so dominant in the Chinese market, which is an increasingly important market for the music and record industry worldwide. But yeah, the revelations last week were twofold. First of all, that Tencent was relying on some financial backers to help it buy this 10% of Universal Music. And it turns out that those financial backers have backed away from the deal. And for a time, apparently, it looked like the whole thing might fall apart.
Yes. So according to Reuters, Tencent had been for about 6 months struggling to get all of the money it needed together to do this deal. And then last month, two US-based private equity funds, KKR and Hellman & Friedman, walked away from the negotiations, taking their money with them, which as a result made it look like the whole thing was going to collapse. But Tencent has apparently turned to Singapore's state-owned investment fund, GIC, which has not only agreed to put up the money needed, but seemingly more money than needed by Tencent, and meaning that they could actually take as much as 30%.
Yeah, so that's the latest report. As you say, these are sources are speaking to Reuters. Yeah, that now there's a whole new team of potential financial backers helping Tencent to take this significant slice in the Universal Music Company. And whereas previously the deal was 10% now with an option to buy 10% down the line, that we're now potentially looking at taking 20% to 30%. Now, whether or not that would be a deal that would see them take 20% and then, as had originally been intended, with the option of taking another 10% down the line, which would take it up to 30%, or whether or not with these new financial backers, they're talking about, you know, taking as much as 30% from the off, we don't yet know, because this is all based on sources. Neither Tencent nor Vivendi nor this Singapore fund GIC have commented on any of this as we record the podcast. But it is looking likely that if this deal goes ahead, Tencent could become an even bigger shareholder in Universal Music, both in the short term and potentially in the long term, which presumably means that those concerns being expressed by the indie community in Europe will only go up.
Yes, if they were going to take it to the regulators over 10%, then anything bigger, then when they're going to go, well, they're going to still go, but they'll go louder, I would guess. And I guess we'll find out, because it's now, although the deal was supposed to be signed already, obviously these financial issues have delayed that, but Reuters seems to think that the deal will now be signed in January, at which point I guess that's when Impala will start moving forward with its opposition to the deal.
Yeah, and one would assume with the deal being formally struck, at that point we will know, are we talking about 20% now with a 10% option down the line, or are we talking about as much as 30% from the off? It's interesting that you mentioned that one of the funds, which apparently had been backing Tencent when they originally put in their offer for 10% for Vivendi, but then pulled out, was KKR. And the reason why that's interesting is earlier in the year, when we knew that Vivendi was going to try and get some buyers for a share up to 50%, as I say, of Universal Music, but it was early days and there hadn't been any formal announcements on quite how that process was going to work. KKR was mooted as a possible bidder, as well as Tencent.
Yes.
So at that point, KKR was being rumoured as a bidder in its own right, it having been a big shareholder alongside Bertelsmann in the creation of the modern BMG company. So when Bertelsmann sold off all the old BMG companies and then decided to set up a new BMG company and buy up lots of catalogues in order to get a big market share quite quickly, KKR was the partner in that. And so we talked about, oh, well, that's interesting. Maybe they're coming back and wanting another play at taking some stake in music rights. But obviously what we don't know is, was it that originally they were interested in their own right, and then once they found out Tencent was interested, they were like, well, maybe we could go and back Tencent's bid? Or is it that, lost in translation, they were always working together, but not anymore? So it would be interesting to see if Tencent do manage to get the money together with their new partners, and if so, exactly how much of Universal Music they would take.
Yes, if we don't already know more about this by the time this episode is out, I'm sure we will find out in the new year.
Now, since the last set list, while I was off in the sunshine.
On holiday.
Working very hard in Thailand.
On holiday.
While you all listened to the Prince special, there was yet more on the whole Taylor Swift versus Big Machine beef, because Billboard gave her an award.
Yeah.
And then there was an interview and a speech alongside that award. And there might have been another award as well. It's the end of a decade, isn't it? So as well as everyone doing Best of 2019 awards, everyone's doing Best of the 2010s awards.
Yeah.
So a lot of awards are going out and Taylor Swift's got them all. And she's giving lots of statements. And talking about her big machine bust-up that we've written about and talked about endlessly at CMU. But in amongst the interview with Billboard that she did, she was talking more about how annoyed she was that Scooter Braun's Ithaca Holdings managed to buy all of her masters through the big machine deal, and that maybe the music industry should have a big rethink about the way masters work and about artists getting access to their masters. And in amongst all of that, one thing she was saying is, you know, maybe we should have a system whereby if a record company that you do a deal with that then controls your rights is thinking of selling those rights, either by selling a catalogue or by selling itself, maybe the artist should get a first right of refusal to buy the rights before somebody else does. So if that had been the convention, she would have had an option to buy the rights before they sold them off as part of the big machine deal to Ithaca Holdings. Yeah. Interesting idea, floated by Taylor Swift. But of course, it's interesting with the whole Swift versus Big Machine debate, because usually when artists are beefing about the music industry, well, the mantra is indie label's good, major label's evil. I mean, that's what everyone likes to think, isn't
everyone it? Everyone knows that.
But obviously, in the Taylor Swift story, Big Machine, independent record company, meanwhile, she's now in business with Universal Music, who she keeps holding up as being the perfect partners for artists releasing their music. So it's slightly weird that the indie is the bad guy and the major is the good guy. But I don't know whether that means that Taylor Swift is thinking, I mean, she isn't, but maybe she could take to Tumblr and write about this over Christmas, that perhaps before Vivendi sells potentially 30% of Universal Music to Tencent, they might like to phone up every single artist whose masters they control and offer them the opportunity to buy them before China's web giant Tencent takes nearly a third of their master rights.
Yeah, well, maybe she hurries up and writes that blog post now, then Universal can get working on phoning all the artists over the Christmas break, because, you know, it's a bit of time to do that. And then I'm sure everyone will be happy with that.
Yeah, if they go to Tencent in January and say,
we've got no more artists.
tell your new investors, the last lot having buggered off, that they're now buying 30% of all the shit music nobody wants. Yeah, that's not going to happen. But it would be interesting, and I am certain that we'll be coming back to the whole Universal Tencent story on Setlist in the new year, unless it all spectacularly falls apart over the Christmas break, I guess.
And finally this week, a dispute has blown up between the estate of late Soundgarden frontman Chris Cornell and his former bandmates in relation to recordings he made before he died for a new Soundgarden album.
Yeah, so this dispute has actually been building behind the scenes for some time now. And actually, if you are a Soundgarden fan and you've been following interviews with the surviving band members over the last year, you may have certainly inferred that there was some sort of dispute going on. But the reason we know about this is it's now gone legal. So Chris Cornell's widow, Vicky Cornell, filed a lawsuit while we have been off, in which she goes into this dispute, albeit very much from her side, in quite some detail. So that's why, although this dispute has been going on for some time, and now with hindsight, when we go back and read some previous interviews with the band, we can see what was going on. But we have quite a lot of information about the nature of this dispute. And it all ultimately centres on seven tracks that Chris Cornell recorded prior to his death in 2017, which the band are keen to work into a final Soundgarden album. And the dispute is on who was involved in those recordings, who owns those recordings, who has control over those recordings. And then some allegations from Vicky Cornell's side that the rest of the band have been misbehaving in order to force her hand.
Yeah, so as you said, if you've been reading interviews with band members, and particularly guitarist Kim Tile is the one who's spoken about this quite a lot. Obviously, he's the band member who tends to be interviewed as well. But we've known that the band wants to finish off a record that they were working on before Chris Cornell died, because he's talked about that in interviews, although he's been he's talked about a dispute but not gone into massive amounts of detail on it. But back in July, he said there were demos, but they were fairly good quality demos, and they were a good enough quality that they could be worked up into more commercially releasable tracks if they were just given the original files that Chris Cornell had been working on in his home studio that had been passed back and forth. So he was saying the surviving members of the band have all got versions of these tracks, but they don't have the kind of the highest quality files that Chris Cornell had at his house that they would need. He talked about there being a dispute over how to move forward with those tracks and getting access to the files. He never, as far as I know, went as far as saying who it was had those tracks, although Vicky Cornell's lawsuit suggests otherwise. So in July, he gave an interview to Music Radar where he said, Right now, that's all kind of stalled. We've tried to get this going 2 years ago, but we're not in possession of any of the demos that Chris was working on. We have copies of them, but what we'd need were the original files so that we'd be able to overdub and finish the record. We are not in possession of those. We've asked nicely. We've suggested that this will benefit all parties if the band could just have the files and we could finish the songs we were working on. But there seems to be some confusion amongst various parties as to what that would entail and how that works and who that would benefit. And it's been tiring. And we can't move on until some future date when someone realises the value of allowing the creative partners to have access to the material. I mean, he's being coy, but you can put two and two together, I guess, and work out who he's talking about in terms of having access to those files. Last month, in an interview with SiriusXM, he talked about this again, saying that stuff's written, it's been demoed and recorded, and it would only need some work to really tinker with and finish off those tracks, record drums, some extra guitars and bass, and make them something that would be satisfying to be released. He's saying there isn't really any reason that that shouldn't happen other than we don't have access to the files. He said then he thought that would happen and it would be ridiculous if it didn't. But these are difficult things, partnerships and property. Again, not naming any names, but I guess you could infer who he was talking about. And as I said, in her lawsuit, Vicky Cornell very much said that people had put two and two together and been trolling her and her children.
Yeah, it's interesting. In those interviews, Tael was kind of implying that what had been going on before Chris Cornell's death was very much a collaboration between the band members, albeit mainly based in their home studios. But he was definitely suggesting, yes, okay, although they were all recording in isolation, files were going backwards and forwards, ideas were being shared. Whereas in the lawsuit that was filed this month, what Vicky Cornell is saying is, no. Chris Cornell was sitting on his own in his studio. He had come together with these recordings in isolation, is basically what the lawsuit is saying. After Chris Cornell's death, the band were then like, okay, can we take these files and rework them? And then basically what the lawsuit says is that she said, yes, we can do that, but with some conditions. And I think the two main conditions were that there was a producer that I think Chris Cornell had been working with on these recordings prior to his death. And so she was like, I want this producer to be involved because he knows what Chris Cornell's vision was when he was doing these recordings. So he can make sure that the music gets finished in a way that Chris Cornell would have been happy with. She also wanted to be consulted on any marketing of any resulting album. And according to the lawsuit, initially that was all agreed. Then she says the band then bailed on those commitments and said they were no longer happy to work with this producer and involve her in the marketing. Then subsequently, they then started demanding the recordings, claiming that actually the recordings did not belong to Chris Cornell and therefore his estate, but they belonged to the band's company because the band were a partnership.
Yeah.
And so therefore any copyright would belong to the band. And so therefore she was obliged to hand over these files. And then the lawsuit basically is saying, we've now got to the point where the band are blackmailing the family in two ways. First of all, by allegedly withholding royalties that are due on other Soundgarden releases. And then secondly, the point you alluded to, that fans have worked out through whatever means that this album is being delayed because of a dispute between the band and the family, and that then idiots online are then trolling both Vicky Cornell and her children about this, and then they're saying they've shown this to the band, and yet the band, they say, continue to badmouth them in the media and so on and so forth. So this is all contained in the lawsuit, and in essence what Vicky Cornell is looking for is confirmation that the copyright in these seven recordings belong to the estate and that the band can't force access to them by claiming copyright ownership. Plus, she wants any royalties that are allegedly being stuck in the system to start flowing through again, by also arguing that his children rely on that income to live off. So yeah, the whole thing has definitely gone legal. As we record, we've not had a response from the band.
No.
So already there is a little bit of inconsistency between what was being said in those interviews and what is said in the lawsuit. So I would suspect, unless some behind-the-scenes settlement can be done over the Christmas break, that we could see a response to that lawsuit or maybe even a countersuit in the new year, which will set out the band's version of events and presumably, given what was said in that interview, would be suggesting that there was much more collaboration going on prior to Chris Cornell's death than the lawsuit suggests.
Definitely. In terms of Kim Tael's interviews over the last few months, he was definitely talking about it being the band working on an album rather than the band waiting for Chris Cornell to send them his songs for them to hear for the first time. And he said that they've got copies of those songs, just not in a studio quality format that they can work up into the finished recordings. So like you say, there's a discrepancy between what the two sides are saying. I mean, Vicky Cornell is not saying she doesn't want these recordings to come out. She's just saying she wants her conditions to be met before she gives up the recordings. So I would expect some settlement will be reached and these recordings will eventually be released.
Yeah, I mean, you'd hope that would happen, because I think, yeah, it's one of those things, isn't it, where I think she would like this final album to be released. The band would definitely want this final album to be released. The fans really want this final album to be released. So ultimately, everybody wants the same thing. There is just some quite tricky stuff going on behind the scenes. So hopefully someone can come in and sort all that out.
Yes, it's just unfortunate when things are being done posthumously and the creative force behind all this is not there anymore, that things do tend to drift into disputes.
But let's be optimistic. Hope this all gets sorted out and we have the final Soundgarden album by the end of next year. Shall we be optimistic? It is the end of the year. It's Christmas.
I guess we could be optimistic.
It's time.
I've never thought of that.
To be optimistic. It is the end of 2019, the final set list of the year. So in the past, sometimes we've done sort of year-end reviews, haven't we? Or as I say, because it's the end of the decade, everyone seems to be doing everything that happened in the 2010s.
Yeah, which we could have done, but it only occurred to me about a month ago that it was the end of the decade, so I didn't get around to doing any of that.
Plus, we have just recently finished a series of podcasts on the biggest stories of the last 20 years.
That's true.
Many of which were the biggest stories of the last 10 years. So it would be a bit stupid, I think, to be doing a set list or maybe a series of set lists on the biggest music business stories of the 2010s when basically we did that. So if you want our perspective on the last decade, go back through our specials, the 20th anniversary specials. They're all sitting there on the website. Some are not the last decade. They sort of predate 2010, but a lot of them either a lot happened in the last 10 years or everything happened in the last 10 years.
Yeah, I think if you do want a bit of music business podcast action in your Christmas break and you haven't listened to our specials, and even if you have, go and listen to those and that'll fill that hole.
And of course, there are the three lawsuit legal battle editions, special editions that we've put out in recent months. We've got a bunch more of those to come.
Yeah.
We're calling it the top 10.
I believe so, yes.
In which case, we've got seven more of those to come in 2020. But there are three of them up there for you to listen to over the Christmas break as well.
But that's all we've got time for on this episode of Setlist, the last one of 2019, the last one of the 2010s. We will be off for 2 weeks now, back in January 2020 for our first edition of the 2020s.
Hooray!
That'll be exciting.
Can't wait.
While we're away, you could email us if you wanted. Our email address is setlist@unlimitedmedia.co.uk. You can find us on social media. We are Setlist Pod wherever we have an account. You could subscribe to Setlist through your favourite podcast app, assuming you haven't already, which, I mean, you probably have. If you haven't, well, probably get a favourite podcast app and start subscribing to podcasts, including this one. But that is it. So I guess we'll wish you a Merry Christmas and a Happy New Year, and we will see you in 2020. Setlist is the music business podcast from CMU. It's presented by me, Andy Malt, and Chris Cook, produced by Matt Peaty. And for more on CMU, go to completemusicupdate.com.
Recorded at Unique Facilities, Setlist is an Unlimited production.